Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Inflation Reduction Act appears on its way to becoming law. What's in it, and how could it help solve the climate crisis? Where will those Inflation Reduction Act dollars go? Data analysis says Republican rural congressional districts could get the most jobs out of the act. And as climate change delivers more and bigger natural disasters, coastal areas could see themselves underwater physically and fiscally. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Senate Democrats have reached a deal on the Inflation Reduction Act, a major part of President Biden's agenda, which would help reduce the economy's carbon emissions and deal with the climate change crisis. Senator Kristen Sinema, an Arizona Democrat, was the last to sign on to the act after some compromise. This gives the Democrats the 50 senators they need to pass the bill, along with Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote. So what's in the Inflation Reduction Act, and how could it help consumers? Colin Layden is the Texas political director of the Environmental Defense Action Fund.
It's a huge win for the planet and for Texas, the Inflation Reduction Act. It's going to deliver what the American people want: lower energy costs, healthier communities, and significant progress on climate change. And it's not coming a moment too soon, right? With rising inflation and all the extreme weather that's been disrupting our lives, including the tremendous heat and drought that we're experiencing right now in Texas. I was going to say, we're talking about, almost $370 billion in clean energy investments. That's the most ambitious piece of climate legislation we've seen in U.S. history. For Texas, a state that is leading the nation in renewable energy, this is going to be a huge economic boon for Texas.
The grid would be greener. We'd be building more wind turbines and solar farms in Texas. We know that's going to mean jobs in rural parts of the state. Also, there's going to be money invested in the electric car manufacturing industry in Texas. So why would people be interested in that?
People should be interested in increasing renewable energy in Texas, because it's been what's keeping our bills down lower, while we've seen natural gas prices triple from a year ago. And, a good portion of our electric grid runs on natural gas power plants. Renewable energy is a great hedge against rising and volatile fossil fuel prices. So from just a pocketbook perspective, the bill is estimated to save anywhere from $200 to $500 on the average bill in the U.S. I would imagine that Texas would be towards the upper piece of that range. And then on the EVs, Texas has one of the highest adoption rates of EVs in the country on the passenger vehicle side. And as you mentioned, this bill will provide $7,500 for an EV purchase that's built in America. And we've got EV manufacturing in Texas. So we've got the Tesla plant here in Central Texas. There's a plant down in San Antonio, and we lead the nation, or we're one of the leading states on innovation in batteries and all sorts of clean tech. It's a bright future for Texas with this sort of clean energy transition.
If this Inflation Reduction Act becomes law, what are we looking at for the reduction of carbon emissions?
I've seen estimates on carbon emissions somewhere between 37 and 41% of a reduction in carbon emissions from 2005 levels, which brings us a good way along the path in reaching President Biden's goal of 50% reduction by 2030. So there's a lot of carbon emission reduction in this bill, that's really a big part of what we're trying to do here is protect the climate here for the coming years.
It's called Inflation Reduction Act. How does it reduce inflation?
Well, I mentioned on the energy side primarily. We've seen a huge increase in our energy costs gasoline at the pump for our vehicles, natural gas for electricity, and investing in renewable energies is a great hedge against the rising increased costs of fossil fuels right now. And energy is one of the primary drivers of inflation that we're experiencing. So tackling energy and bringing those costs down over the coming months and years is going to contribute to in a huge way to reducing inflation.
There's also this concern about energy storage. Is there like a part of energy storage in this bill?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the exact numbers on energy storage, but it's clean energy tax credits is essentially the primary vehicle here for the clean energy stuff, and it's got tax incentives for solar, wind, energy storage, and you know, if you look at what we're adding in Texas right now, it's a lot of solar, which has been great for the summer months and helping us get through this heat wave, and then it's solar storage. We're seeing a lot of interest in adding more storage to the Texas grid, and this will provide incentives for that.
People are very concerned about the stability of the Texas grid. What would the Inflation Reduction Act mean for stabilizing the ERCOT grid?
Well, it's got money for energy efficiency, which is basically helping us weatherize our homes and businesses so that they're more energy efficient. That's one of the primary ways we can help make our grid here in Texas more resilient by reducing the amount of power and the amount of electricity we need when it's hot and when it's cold.
There's $20 billion for climate-friendly agriculture. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, the bill has $20 billion for climate-friendly agriculture. It's going to help U.S. farmers and rural communities cut emissions while making, you know, food production more resilient to the impacts that we're experiencing from climate change. You know, and these are going to create jobs and help revitalize some of our rural communities.
Colin Layden is the Texas political director of the Environmental Defense Action Fund. It doesn't look like the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act is going to get much help from Republican lawmakers. The GOP is firmly against greening the economy and moving towards renewables like solar and wind. But looking at where the dollars will be going and where the new jobs will be generated, it looks like Republican stronghold congressional districts could benefit the most from the Inflation Reduction Act. That's according to Intersection, a new company based in Houston specializing in data-driven insights on the U.S. energy system. Jeff Davies is the co-founder of Intersection.
So I'm building out a data platform basically for insights into the energy markets and really focusing on, you know, the transition from oil and gas to renewables. So as part of that, I was playing around with some data sets, came across some EPA data on emissions, and just for fun really said, hey, let me go ahead and it's about 10,000 line items of the biggest emitting facilities in the U.S., let me go ahead and geolocate these to congressional districts and maybe see where most of the emissions are coming from in the U.S. And as I did that, it struck me, like, why not look at the other side of the equation rather than who is emitting, who is trying to mitigate the damage from those emissions? So let me pull from the EIA website, you know, all of the existing and planned battery projects, wind farms and solar farms. In the U.S., that's all utility scale stuff. So wouldn't it be capturing like residential solar? The data sticks out. A, most of the wind in the U.S. is built where the best wind is. And in the piece, we have a map from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory that shows effectively where the best wind is in the U.S. And that's right in, you know, kind of really tornado alley, for lack of a better kind of way to phrase it, right, middle America. Right down through, you know, Texas, Oklahoma, Iowa, et cetera, Kansas, all the states that are big wind states, right? So it makes sense that the vast majority of wind in the U.S. is sited where the best wind is. And then the second part of that, you know, Bloomberg brought a data set to me and said, well, maybe we should look at this and see if this is just an urban versus rural story. So they had a data set from their City Labs group that basically took all the congressional districts based on population density, kind of bucketed those into either rural or rural suburban mix or suburban or urban type of districts. And so we married that data together with the data set from the EIA, which showed where renewable plants were being built effectively. And what the data shows is kind of what I said, that wind is where the best wind is in the U.S., which happens to be in a lot of red and rural districts. But also, renewables generally are sited where there's land, where there's open land. And a lot of those areas are ultimately rural areas, rural or rural suburban areas.
So I've been out covering wind energy and these development projects for a long time. What you're telling me is really not that new if you've been out into these areas and you talk to landowners who have a few of those propellers put out there, and they'll tell you that it generates revenue for their land. It's a good thing for the local economy, and they don't mind looking at them too much. That experience has not really been translated very well into the popular dialogue about how we're going to green America and how the red rural areas are opposed to that. So you have the data now that shows that this isn't just anecdotal. We're seeing this across America, that this could be of benefit, economic benefit, job generation for these parts of Texas and middle part of America. This could be a really good thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when you look at the data that we pulled together and just looking at planned wind, battery, and solar projects in the U.S. So, and this is stuff that, the data sets through April, so it would have some stuff that's already, if you look at that on a congressional district basis and break it into, GOP and Democrat or red, let's just call it red blue districts, the analysis showed that there was $107 billion of planned capital investment into renewables in the U.S. And of that $107 billion, $86 billion of it was going into red districts, right? So if you look at total renewable capacity in the U.S., so this is just operating and planned, 70% of it is in districts that are characterized as pure rural or rural suburban mix. Most renewables are in red districts. Most renewables are in rural districts. And the amount of investment going into those districts, I guess you could theoretically take that $86 billion and multiply it by 70%, and you'd get somewhere around kind of $60 or $70 billion going into red rural districts.
Well, what about the trade-off if we're going to be greening the grid and not using natural gas, I guess, to create electricity? Would it be a net loss if these were places that were providing that natural gas?
Well, I mean, if you look at, any kind of projections, EIA or other projections, I think it's a number of years, certainly 10 or 20 years before you see any degradation of natural gas usage here in the U.S., right? Because, or natural gas production, I should say. So, any kind of amount of reduced demand for natural gas from the power markets is certainly being offset by LNG exports right now. So, LNG exports, we just started in this country 2015-ish. We're at kind of 12 billion cubic feet a day. With that expected to grow as we effectively send cleaner power over to Europe, especially exacerbated by the Russian crisis going on right now as they shut Europe off from natural gas. So I don't think there's a lot of risk to landowners, rural landowners, that they're not going to see as much natural gas production. And certainly if you just look at the power markets as well, gas is really replacing coal. There's not a whole heck of a lot of, renewables displacing gas right now. Gas is replacing coal. I would expect that trend to continue. So unless you're, a landowner who has coal reserves, I don't think there's a lot of risk to lower royalties as an example.
You mentioned battery manufacturing as also one of these benefits to rural areas. How big will that be?
Less battery manufacturing, more just battery projects that will. So these battery storage projects a lot of time are sited where wind farms are or solar farms are, or they can be sited by themselves as well, but they, you know, attempt to, you know, store power.
Okay, so you're talking about large-scale energy storage. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah, exactly.
Okay. I was thinking about making lithium batteries.
You know, and this is just my own opinion. I do think, you know, because if you look at the emission side of the equation, the vast majority of the emissions in this country are also coming from red rural districts as well. If you look at the top 100 districts and top 100 emitting facilities in the U.S., 74 of those are coal plants. So, you know, you think about, you know, how do you convince, you know, the Alabama 6th district, I believe, has the largest emitting facility in the U.S., a coal plant. You know, how do you convince them to shut that coal plant down? I think you do that through, you know, some carrots, and some of that may be, hey, let's build a battery or solar or wind, you know, some component of that process. Let's go ahead and build that in, you know, that district to kind of offset the pain of, you know, those jobs that you lose, the tax base that you lose, et cetera, et cetera. That makes a lot of sense to me to do that. So, you know, that's really just kind of an opinion, so to speak. But I think there, you know, as part of, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act and other legislation that, you know, is coming down the pipe, I think the best way for us as a country to, you know, get rid of some of these large emitting, you know, coal plants is to go to these communities and say, hey, what can we do to replace, you know, the jobs, the economic benefits with, you know, cleaner, better, you know, cleaner power, cheaper power, and let's build some manufacturing plants that tie you into this green build out as well. You know, that's really just opinion, but I think a lot of that makes sense to me.
My point of view, I want to see the greening of the grid as fast as possible. I think it's a good thing for the planet, and would love to see this happen sooner than later. Now would be preferable. Looking at what you're telling me, I'm seeing, you know, one of the major roadblocks to doing that, the political block that we have, seems to be, in a way, artificial because of what we're seeing on the ground in these areas and how it would benefit. So, I mean, does this give you some level of hope that that political block could shatter because of this would be good for those red areas?
I mean, that was really my big takeaway, right? Like, to me, you look at the politics at the federal side versus what we did is really take a look at it on a local basis. Now, we are, you know, segregating the data into kind of, you know, federal districts at the end of the day. But clearly, at least from a perception perspective, you know, this is my belief, my opinion, from a perception perspective, I think a lot of the U.S. believes Republicans are against renewables and Democrats are for renewables. And when you really dig into the data, Republican districts are doing far, far more than kind of Democratic districts from the perspective of building out renewable power generation capacity here in the U.S. And it's not even close, right? It's roughly 80% or more of all capacity in the U.S. is going into red districts. Like I said, some of that is just because wind is currently the largest component of our renewable capacity, and wind is in certain states because that's where the best wind is. But when you think about the jobs, like I said, when you think about the jobs, when you think about the tax benefits, there's a, you know, I just have read this recently. There's a wind farm in West Texas called the Hale Community, you know, wind project. And, you know, I know they paid around $25 million in property taxes or expect to as part of that project. And that just, you know, goes locally, and they share the benefits of their production tax credits with the local community from a power price perspective. When you think about all the benefits that kind of accrue to red rural districts mostly, I'm hopeful that, you know, it's more kind of bark than bite when you read or when you see some of these on the right side speak against renewables. When, again, in the article, for example, we talk about Lauren Boebert, who kind of many times has said how stupid renewables are. But if you look at her district is 16th in the country out of 435 districts for planned renewable projects, right? So there's a difference. There's a perception versus reality, or at least kind of there's a difference in what's being said at the federal level than what's being done at the local level. And, you know, I'm hopeful that that continues, but I'm also hopeful that the gap of the talk versus the action narrows as well over time, because I think we get more done if there's less kind of talk against it, so to speak. And we all, at the end of the day, when you look at this data, there's a codependency, right? Because if you were just look at number of districts, Democrat districts are doing less, far less. There's far more Democratic districts, and this makes a ton of sense, of course, that basically have no renewable projects, both because those are urban areas, right? And there isn't room for a big, you know, solar farm, or there isn't place to site wind farms in a city, for example. So there's a codependency because the left, so to speak, or the Democrats really want to get this stuff done, but they don't have the land, they don't have the areas to do it. And so, you know, like I said, there needs to be a win-win where we convince each other that it's beneficial for both sides. It's beneficial for everybody, which is my opinion. Sounds like it's your opinion as well. It's good for the environment. It's good for the economy. It's good for jobs. Oh, by the way, if you want to, you know, come at me from the perspective of, well, we're subsidizing renewables. Well, if you were to look at the map of U.S. GDP, it's going to be very similar to a voting map. And, you know, the vast majority of the GDP in the U.S. comes from, and therefore the tax base, right, and employment base comes from urban areas and Democratic areas. It's just a population density thing at the end of the day. So if we're subsidizing renewables, the way that I think about it after working through this data set is Democratic kind of urban areas are subsidizing renewables being built in red rural areas. And why would the rural areas be against that?
Jeff Davies is the co-founder of Intersection. Due to man-made climate change, disaster after disaster is pounding the nation. Wildfires, hurricanes, floods, and drought. They're taking lives and wrecking landscapes, communities, homes, and businesses. This means insurance companies are having to write a lot of big checks. And as we enter the busiest part of hurricane season, things could get even worse for the coastal areas. A leading global scientist, Alex Kolker, says there is a serious threat to coastal cities, both physically and fiscally. Kolker is a professor at the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium.
Definitely a challenge in Louisiana, and becoming more of a challenge. Something only close to 7 insurance companies have gone bankrupt in Louisiana over the last year. And that's making getting insurance hard for a lot of people, getting homeowners insurance difficult, logistically difficult, and it's making it more expensive for a lot of people too.
So what does that mean that these insurers have gone out of business? I mean, you would think, you know, insurance is a good business to be in.
They've had too many damages to deal with. We've had a bunch of storms in Louisiana over the last couple of years. In 2020, we were in the cone of uncertainty, the area where a storm could hit something like 7 times. And one of those storms, Hurricane Laura, was particularly intense over in the Lake Charles area. And that was followed up by 2021, in which we had Hurricane Ida strike the Central Coast. So there's been a lot of hurricane damage over the last just over the last couple of years, and that's really expensive for these companies. And you know, theoretically, I guess the companies could raise premiums to keep pace with rising costs, but to be fair, a lot of people couldn't pay those higher premiums. I'll just give you myself as an example. I'll be okay. I've got a scientist's salary, but my insurance company went bankrupt, and I was able to get new insurance through the state through their backup plan, but that cost me an extra $2,000 a year. And I'm supposed to maybe be getting a refund from my insurance company that went bankrupt. But that is that's an additional $2,500 or so that I'm out. So just for me, that's close to $4,000 of expenses that I wasn't expecting. You magnify that across the state, and that becomes an issue.
So Louisiana has a state-operated like insurer of last resort, like we have in Texas, which is the TWIA, which is the Texas Windstorm Insurance Agency. And it is the place you go when you can no longer get commercial insurance. And it has it's become bigger and bigger. Problem is, it doesn't have enough money in it if there was a major natural disaster to cover all the claims.
We've got a similar setup here in Louisiana. In Louisiana, there's the Citizens Insurance Program, which is essentially the same deal. It's an insurer of last resort. And I'm not going to get out and tell you that they won't be able to settle every claim, but things could be tough. Just as an example, there's sort of a separate agency that manages the bankrupt insurance companies, and they are now trying to sell $600 million worth of bonds to cover the costs of the insurance companies that have gone out of business. That is an emerging story. With all of these storms, it's harder and harder for insurance companies to make a business out of this. This current debacle is on the wind damage side. Is wind damage from these hurricanes. There is a separate issue with flood insurance, and the federal flood insurance rates are going up for many people around the country. But that's in some ways a separate matter from this, because these companies aren't dealing with floods, they're dealing with wind damage.
These hurricanes are getting bigger, stronger, lasting longer, doing more damage. So there is a concern about what this means for the coastal areas of Louisiana, Texas, Florida.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people live in the coastal zone. The coastal zone in many ways is a great place to live. A lot of our biggest cities around the country are somehow in the coastal zone. Houston, New Orleans, Miami, New York, all these cities are coastal cities. And as the climate changes, it makes it more difficult to live in these places. And the hurricanes we're having much larger hurricanes. We're having more frequent hurricanes, more intense hurricanes. And that's one part of our changing climate. And it makes living in the coastal zone more difficult. And yeah, a lot of us live in the coastal zone, whether that's in New Orleans, whether that's in Houston, Galveston, Brownsville, Miami, Tampa, Big Bend of Florida. A lot of people live in the coastal zone. A lot of our economy is based in the coastal zone.
Yeah. So you called it an insurance debacle. So are we on the precipice? Are you seeing that we're going to have?
I mean, yeah, I think we're at a turning point. I mean, like I said, Louisiana, we've seen 7 insurance companies go bankrupt. I think that this is a critical juncture in how we are dealing with the finances of climate change. You know, places may be underwater financially before they're underwater physically.
Alex Kolker is a professor at the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. Check out our website, tpr.org, for past Texas Matters episodes. And you can download us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.